Okay, so Ted wants explanation of the passage that I asked him to read this morning. So yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to get into the explanation of that particular story. But mostly what we're going to do today is talk about Sabbath and the ideas behind Sabbath. And I just want to say up front, what I don't want you to hear me say is that we need to return to a post-Reformation idea of what Sabbath means to us as a Christian church. Okay? Do not hear me say that. If you go away hearing me say that this morning, you need to call me up and we'll talk. We'll meet for coffee or something and we'll talk. So I just want to make sure that you understand that that's not where we're going with this. So when we embrace the post-Reformation idea of Sabbath, the idea was, oh, Sabbath, that's part of the law. We don't have to follow the law. So no, Sabbath is not going to be part of our Christian ideal. But on the other hand, we did embrace that. And clear up until, I won't even give a date. Okay. But for a long time, we had the remnants of the idea of Sabbath that permeated our American Christian culture. I remember this one time. I'm going out over Facebook so other people can hear this, but I'm going to tell you this anyway. I've worked at camp for a long time, and I grew up going to camp. And all of a sudden, one summer, we weren't allowed to run the speedboat on Sunday. And I was like, last year we did, and it was okay, but all of a sudden we weren't allowed to anymore. So that idea of the Sabbath hung on even through my own childhood, and some of you guys might be able to think back to your own experiences with what we called Sabbath, even in a Reformation culture. So we had discarded the Sabbath, but then we were hanging on to some of the dregs of our ideas of Sabbath and not sure really how they fit into our faith. And then all of a sudden, the psychologists started saying, oh, Sabbath, that's a good idea. God was right, after all. But they have made it into a personal rest period that's good for us. And the Sabbath in our idea right now has become all about me. Everything is about me. The Sabbath is about me. I need to have a rest. I need to have a break. I need to have what I want, right? Okay, so we're going to take a look at the original idea of Sabbath and then figure out how that fits into what our mindset should be toward that. So I started out by having Ted read that passage. This is a Bible story that you might have heard in Sunday school. And it ends with, the day that Jesus did this miracle was on the Sabbath. And so that's going to be our springboard into talking about the Sabbath. But I do want to explain that story to you a little bit. So how many of you have heard that story from Sunday school? Right? Okay, do you have a picture in your mind of a flannel graph? Remember those? And remember the angel of the Lord comes down to stir the water, and the angel has like long robes and he has wings and a big stick and he's stirring up the water, right? Okay, Sunday school. Discard that idea, okay? You probably never heard a pastor explain this to you so that you can understand. There should have been lots of questions when you heard that story as a child. One of the questions should be, what in the world is God doing? This is so arbitrary. God sends an angel down, random times, stirs the water, the first guy in gets healed. This is so arbitrary. Our God is not an arbitrary God. So how do we fit this in? Turns out it's really easy to fit in. So here is the background behind that. Oh, first of all, before I go there, how many of you followed along in your Bibles when Ted was reading? Did you notice a difference between what Ted read and what you were looking at? How many of you are missing verse 4 in your translation? Okay, so here's the interesting explanation behind the missing of verse 4. That's the verse that says, The angel of the Lord at seasons came down to stir the water, and the first person in was healed. So why is that there sometimes and not there sometimes? The answer is that there are two different options, and the Bible scholars don't really know for sure the timeline behind these options. But one of the options is that this was part of the original document, and later somebody looked at that and said, well, no, that's too confusing. We need to take that out of there. People are going to be confused about this whole angel of the Lord business. And so they took it out. Or it could be that it was never in the first place in the original documents, but somebody looked at it and said, that story doesn't make any sense without an explanation of what's going on. So they put it in. Okay? We don't know which one. But it turns out it doesn't matter either. So, here's the explanation of that story. Sorry. So, personal aside, between the last time I was up here and this week that I'm up here, I had COVID. I still have the COVID cough. I still have stuff in my throat. So if I blow your eardrums out coughing into the microphone, I'm sorry. So, the explanation and the description of this pool of Bethesda is very precise. This pool is by the sheep gate, which puts it by the temple. It's got five porches or colonnades. It's got two pools. Very precise description in John's gospel. Okay, so the archaeologists came in and they started digging there and they found a pool by the sheep gate, but it didn't have five porches. It was different. It was totally different than what John described. And so Bible critics said, oh, this story is made up. John, the author, just made this story up to prove a point. So they went on from there and pretty much discarded the whole story. But then they kept digging and they dug past the Crusader temple that was there on the site, and they dug past the Byzantine ruins, and they got down to the very bottom layer, and lo and behold, here are two pools, five colonnades, exactly as John has described. And you can go there, and you can stand on the floor where Jesus stood to talk to this man today. And it's kind of awesome, actually. So here is the pool of Bethesda, exactly as John had described. But something else that they discovered was that this pool and the colonnades are built on the same lines and the same plan as pools across the Greco-Roman world. So the ones that they have found in Greece, they know what they're for, and they have a name. They're called Asclepions. And Asclepions were healing centers dedicated to the Greek god Asclepius. So what we have here in the Pool of Bethesda is a healing center dedicated to a foreign god, not the God of Israel, not Yahweh. Okay? So, the idea then is that we have this man here who is a Jewish man, but he's in a healing center of Asclepius. And here's the deal with the angel stirring the water. So this is written as a metaphor, the people's understanding of what was happening at the time. So there's two pools there. There's the upper pool and there's the lower pool. And the lower pool is where the people, the sick people, hung out. And the upper pool, they kept snakes. Okay? Because snakes are a symbol of healing and have been since antiquity. So there's snakes in the upper pool. The people are hanging in the lower pool. Well, every now and then they would open the sluice gates between the two pools, and the snakes and the water would pour down from the upper pool into the lower pool. Okay? So now here's all this mass of snakes doing what to the water? Stirring it up. Okay? So this is the idea behind this story. It's a pagan story. It's a pagan temple. It's a pagan place to be and a pagan happening. The angel of the Lord is their description for why this happens the way it did. Okay, now across the Greco-Roman world, these Asclepions were very truly centers of healing. That's not all they did. It wasn't just like this magic thing. Like they had doctors there, they had certain treatments that they would give people. But that's where this story comes from. So Jesus walks in to a pagan worship center and sees a Jewish man waiting for healing from a different god. Okay, so do you notice that when Jesus heals him, he doesn't say to him, oh, I'll help you into the water, or let's go jump in now. Okay, he totally ignored what was taking place in the temple at that time. He healed the man without the power of the Greek god. All right, pick up your mat and walk. So the guy did, and he walked out. And the first thing that happened to him is he's accosted by the Committee for the Investigation of Un-Jewish Activities. Right? You're carrying your mat. There wasn't anything. Dude, you're healed. That's awesome. Oh, by the way, put down your mat. Right? No, there wasn't that at all. It was just like, oh, here's this man. He's carrying his mat. He's breaking the Sabbath. Okay? So he then says to the people who have accosted him, the Pharisees, well, it's not really my fault. It's that guy's fault. That guy told me what to do. Okay? So, we're going to look at Jesus' response to the Pharisees and how he pointed them in a different direction. But before we do that, we have to get a brief history of the Jewish idea of Sabbath. So I want you to look at your sheets. If you do not have one, grab one. If there's none left to grab, grab your neighbors and make them share with their husband or wife. Okay? Okay, this is going to be a really brief history because this is something that we could talk about like for a long time, but we're not going to. So, the first time we see this day as being a special day is in Genesis 2. So this is just after creation. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Okay, now that word for resting is kind of an unfortunate translation that has molded our idea of what Sabbath is. That word actually, although it encompasses the idea of rest, it should also encompass the idea of celebration. So this would be like restful celebration. But it's a celebration. It's not just not working. Okay, so the picture that we should have here is God reached into the world that he had created, which had become a chaotic wasteland. He reached into it and he brought order to the chaos. He separated the day from the night. He told the sun where to go. He put the moon and stars in the right place. He separated the land and the sea. He's bringing order into chaos. At the end of the sixth day, when he says, this is very good, culminated with his giving life to this creation that he has just made. Okay, now the next day, the seventh day, he celebrates because he has won the battle with chaos. He has brought order into chaos and it's ready to go. So this is like the pre-race celebration, right? Okay, so that's the first time we see this day as being special. And then we jump not to the Ten Commandments, which when I was looking at all these passages and stuff, this actually surprised me. The first place that we get the command, that we see the command to celebrate Sabbath in a certain way is before the Ten Commandments were given. So this happens in Genesis 16, verses 23 through 26. He said to them, this is what the Lord commands. Tomorrow is to be a day of Sabbath rest, of celebration rest, a holy celebration to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left and keep it until morning. The context of this is the children of Israel in the desert and the manna has just come down. And they're like, what is this? What are we supposed to do with it? How do we deal with this? Okay, so this is what God is speaking into, that setting. So they saved it until morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink or get maggots in it. Eat it today, Moses said, because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You will not find any of it on the ground today. 6 days you are to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will not be any. Okay, so they gather the food for 6 days. On the sixth day, they gather enough for the seventh day, and so they don't have to gather on the seventh. Okay, now I want you to think about the culture that the people lived in at this time, across the board, across the earth. When you got out of bed in the morning, the first thing you had to do was go kill your own breakfast. And then for the rest of the day, all you thought about was, how am I going to get lunch? You ate lunch. Next thought, how am I going to get supper? You eat supper, you go to bed, you get up in the morning, what's for breakfast? Every single minute of the day is taken up with, how are you going to survive? Am I going to survive through this day? Will there be enough food? Not just in the desert, but in any lifestyle there. Okay, so God steps into this idea, and not only does he give them manna, which they still had to work for, but he gives them a day where they don't have to think about survival. On this day, I will take care of you. You don't have to labor for your survival. This is an incredible gift. At this point in the story, we should be looking at Sabbath as an incredible gift that God just gave his people. Okay, I want you to hang on to that idea. Exodus 20. This is where it goes into the Big Ten. Okay. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, your son or daughter, your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. Okay, so this is where it gets right encoded right into the law. But then we get some more information about it in Exodus 31, and this is kind of interesting also. The Israelites are to observe the Sabbath, celebrating it for the generations to come as a lasting covenant. The Israelites are to observe the Sabbath, celebrating it as a lasting covenant. It will be a sign between me and the Israelites forever. In 6 days, the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day, he rested and was refreshed. Okay, so we get a little bit more information. We get some information about this command to celebrate the Sabbath is a command to the Israelites, and it's a sign of the covenant. What's the other sign of the covenant? Circumcision. Circumcision is a sign of the covenant between God and Israel. And now we have the Sabbath, the celebration of the Sabbath, as being a sign of the covenant. And it ties back, every time you read about the Sabbath, it ties back to the creation, to God bringing order into chaos, to God bringing life to the earth. Okay, one more thing we learn about it in Deuteronomy. Observe the Sabbath by keeping it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. Da, da, da. On it you shall not do any work, neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants can rest. Okay, so now, not only is this a gift that God has given to the Israelites, but now he's telling them, you need to turn around and give this as a gift to the people who are under you. So he's talking to the patriarchal head of the clan, and he's saying, all these people that you order around, your son and daughter who have to do what you say, your male and female servants, your animals, you are now going to give them this gift that I gave you. So the Sabbath celebration then becomes a gift that is passed down from God to his people Israel, to the people that they're in charge of. Okay? So, now, something happened between the time that this instruction was given to the time when Jesus came on the earth. Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament, and 400 years passes between Malachi and Jesus coming on the scene. And we don't have written evidence of what took place during that time, but we do have historical evidence from the world around us. And here's what happened during that time to change the idea of what the Sabbath is. This guy named Alexander the Great started conquering the world, and pretty soon he came to the place where the Jews lived. And he came and said, I'm going to conquer you guys, but guess what I'm going to do for you? I am going to bring in my Hellenistic culture and offer it to you. Now, Hellenism is, the culture of Hellenism is the Greek culture, and it was, the hallmark of it is, if it feels good, do it. So this is the idea that they were bringing in to the Israelite, the Jewish culture. And a group of people sprang up in the culture that did not think that that was such a good idea. They said, you know, God gave us these other instructions and we should continue to follow these instructions, not turn to Greece and do what they say we should do. And these men were called the Pharisees. The word Pharisee means separate or separatist. They wanted to stay separate from the Greek culture. So they became the gatekeepers of the Judean culture, the Jewish culture. So at first, they would teach people and tell people what the law of God said. So they would teach from the Torah. But gradually, as they got more and more power and they saw that people were like doing what they said, they decided that they needed to make more laws. So what they did was put up fences. And this is a term that they use. They're not like ashamed of this term. We're going to put fences around the law of God to make sure that the common man does not break God's law. So this is what that looks like. Okay, so picture a rose bush on a hill. Anybody could come up, smell the roses, but the Pharisees said, oh, we need to keep people from picking these roses. So they put up a sign that said, please do not pick the flowers. But that's not good enough. We need to keep people away from it, because what if they can't read, or what if they just do it anyway? So they built a wire cage around the rose bush. So now you can't pick the flowers. Okay. But then they started worrying, well, people might still, you know. So now the next thing they did was they built a fence around the bottom of the hill. So now you can't even get close to the rose bush, and now you can't smell it anymore. Okay. So, but they're still worried. So pretty soon they built a room and locked the door and called it a Federal Reserve, right? and now nobody can see the roses. Nobody is welcome to come in and celebrate the roses. So this is what the Pharisees have done with various laws of God. And for the Sabbath, what they did was they started making rules. So they would sit around in their conclave and they would say, okay, so what constitutes work? What if we do this, it's going to break the Sabbath? And they came up with measurements and ideas. And one of the important things was carrying. So remember the guy's carrying his mat, right? Well, one of the important rules about the Sabbath is how far you're allowed to carry things. So they measured. They had a measuring stick and that you can carry it this far and no farther. But if you have to go that far, what do you do? You know, so you're carrying food to the table and your table's farther away than what you're allowed to carry on the Sabbath. So you had to, as the person cooking the meal, you carried it so far and you set it on the floor and somebody else came and picked it up and carried it the rest of the way to the table. Okay? So we're pretty good at getting around rules, aren't we? Right? So all these rules that were erected around the idea of the Sabbath so that people wouldn't break the Sabbath. Okay, so I don't remember if I said this once before in here, but still to this day, when you go over to Israel, there's a Sabbath elevator. And it's too much work to push the button. So you don't push the button. The elevator just stops at every floor as it goes up and down. Okay, so they've decided that the rabbis have decided that pushing the button is work. Apparently walking up and down the stairs is not as much work as pushing the button, but. So there's all these rules that are surrounding the Sabbath. Just a moment. So one of the rules is not carrying on the Sabbath. Another rule has to do with how to treat life. And Jesus addresses this, and we're going to look at what Jesus says in a minute. But there's three things. Another one is passing judgment. So the judge's council was not allowed to sit on the Sabbath, and judgment was not allowed to be passed on the Sabbath. Okay? So these three things are super important in the list of rules that people are not allowed to do. You're not allowed to judge. You're not allowed to, certain things about dealing with life that you're not allowed to do and that you are allowed to do. And then also the idea of carrying. So Jesus is about to address these three issues when he talks to the Pharisees who are coming against him. So he gives an apologetic. A couple of Sundays ago, I talked about how the Gospel of John is put together, where John writes that he tells a story about Jesus, and then he tells Jesus' response to what happens in that story. And you can go through the Gospel of John, and you can see that laying out. Well, Jesus has a response to what's happening in this story, and we're going to take a look at that. So this is John 5. We're going to start at 17. But before we start reading that, we're going to ask ourselves a question. Did Jesus break the Sabbath? From our post-Reformation Protestantism, we say, yes, Jesus broke the Sabbath. And so that proves that we don't have to do all these Sabbath rules that the Jews had to do. But that idea that Jesus has broken the Sabbath is one of the biggest stumbling blocks that Jews have to get over today to be able to embrace Jesus as their Messiah. Because they look at his actions through our cultural lens and they say, how could Jesus have come from God? How could he be the Messiah if he doesn't follow God's law? So we're going to take a look at this, and the answer to the question, did Jesus break the Sabbath, actually turns out to be no. He did not break the Sabbath, and he's about to prove to them that he didn't break the Sabbath. Got to catch up with my notes here. So let's take a look at the handout that I gave you. This is Jesus responding to the Pharisees. My Father has been working until now, and I have been working. And then there's a little insert. When Jesus says that, the Pharisees are like, no, you did not just say that out loud. You just made yourself equal with God. And so now they're mad, madder than they were before. And then Jesus keeps talking. The Son does nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do. This is the intro to what he's about to say. Okay? Now, this is a defense. His argument is a legal defense. He's got 4 points, and you can see them on the sheet because I have them starting with the word for. So this is a word that is translated different ways in different translations, but basically it's like point number one, point number two, point number three, point number four. Okay, but they're also in a modified chiastic structure. So you see that in the indents that I have here and the colors that show what is parallel to each other. So let's go through that, okay? That's why it's important that you have something to look at, as I'm saying, because I'm going to say, okay, look at the green. Okay, now look at the blue, right? So if you don't have one, like I said, find somebody who does. So, okay, so point number one, proof. Whatever the Father does, in the same way, the Son also does. So just to paraphrase that, Jesus is saying, if the Father does it, then the Son will do it. And that's an important point because the Pharisees have given God the right, this is kind of funny to phrase it that way, they've given God the right to do some things on the Sabbath. Okay, one of them is carrying. They say it's okay for God to carry on the Sabbath. Because one of the rules was you could carry something if it was inside your own courtyard. You can't carry something outside your courtyard. But they say the whole earth is God's courtyard, so he can carry in his courtyard. Okay, the other thing God can do is God can give life. Are people born on Sunday? Are people born on Sabbath for the Jews? Yes, they are. So that's God giving life. So it's okay for God to give life on the Sabbath. The other thing is passing judgment. There, people are not allowed to pass judgment on the Sabbath, but God can, because do people die on the Sabbath? They do. And so God has to pass judgment on them. So those three things, they have given God the right to do on the Sabbath. So Jesus is going to take those three things now and apply them to himself. Whatever the Father does, in the same way the Son also does. So those three things that the Father does. Okay, so number two, point number two. The Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself does, and he will show him greater works than these that you may marvel. Okay, so I've talked about the importance of the format of the rhetoric from the Middle East. And we've talked about the chiasm and we've talked about parallelisms. Well, this particular cameo, particular verse, we'll call it because we're used to poetry verses. Okay, this is reverse parallelism, and you can see that because of the way I've indented it here. So the first line and the last line are parallel with each other. So they're talking about the same thing. And then the two middle lines are talking about the same things. Okay? So what's interesting about this is that last line, that you may marvel. When we read that verse, if we don't see this format, we think that we're supposed to marvel at the works. Right? He will show you greater works that you may marvel. Okay? But when we put it in parallel with that top line, we're marveling at something different. We're not marveling at the works. We see the works, but the works point us from the Son to the Father. And what we're doing is we're marveling at the relationship. We're marveling that the Father loves the Son so much that he allows him to do the same work that the Father does. Okay? So the marvel is at the relationship, not at the works. And the shows part, shows him all things that he himself does. The showing is giving evidence. It's giving proof of that love that the Father has for the Son. And it is not just for an internal relationship between the Father and the Son, but because of the works, it's for all to see. So there's proof that the Father has this relationship with the Son. The Son is doing works that everyone can see so that they can marvel at that relationship. That's what that verse means. Okay, and then we come to the center of this modified chiasm. As the Father raises the dead and gives life to them in the same way the Son gives life to whom he will. Okay, so remember that the Sabbath is always talked about in context of creation. So this particular verse here is talking about the life that God gave at creation. The Father raises the dead, the Father gives life, just as he did at creation. In the same way that the Father did that at creation, the Son is doing that now. He's bringing life. He's bringing chaos. He's bringing order into chaos. Okay, so think about this guy who just got healed. Okay, God steps into his life. He brings order into the chaos of this sick man's life. And that's what Jesus is showing that God, the Father, is doing. So that's what he's telling. That's what he's telling his interrogators. Okay, and then the last one. The Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son. So here we have that third thing. Okay, we've dealt with the carrying, we've dealt with life-giving, and now we're dealing with judgment. He has committed all judgment to the Son, that they should honor the Son just as they honor the Father who sent him. So once again, we have that idea of relationship, the relationship between the Father and the Son. If you honor the Father, you'll honor the Son. If you honor the Son, you're honoring the Father. And this is within the idea of judgment. Okay? So, the next one. He who hears my word and believes in him who sent me has everlasting life, shall not come into judgment, and has passed from death unto life. Okay, so if you believe, then you pass from death, which we've seen that in the account of the Israelites wandering through the desert. They were struggling for food before God sent them the manna. They were on their way to death. But God steps in and he gives them the gift of the manna and then the incredible gift of the day of rest. And that death is swallowed up with life because of what God has done. And the Sabbath then is their celebration of acknowledging what God has done in the desert, passing from death into life. Okay, now I want to, before we keep going in the Gospel of John here, I want to take you to a couple of other places in the Bible where Jesus addresses the Sabbath. And we're not going to turn to them, because we don't have time. We're not going to turn to them, but I'll just kind of give you a general overview of Jesus' response when the Pharisees say to him, what? You can't do that. This is the Sabbath. Okay? Jesus says, the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. Okay, so that puts him as over the Sabbath regulations that the Pharisees, those fences that the Pharisees have built. He also says the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Okay, so we saw that when God gave them that gift in the desert. The Sabbath was made to be a gift to humankind, not that humankind should serve the Sabbath. And then in one point, he's talking to the Pharisees and he says, which one of you that has a donkey, it's in one story, or a sheep in another story, that falls into a well, which one of you would not get him out? Okay, this is the idea of life. And it was encoded into their fences that it was okay. If your sheep falls into a pit, if your donkey falls into a well, it's okay for you to get him out because you're saving a life, right? Another place he says, it's okay for you to lead your donkey to water, right? Then why isn't it okay for me to give life to this man I just healed? Okay, so it's encoded in their law. If your animal is thirsty, you can work enough to give it a drink. And then Jesus says, which should you do on the Sabbath? Should you do good or should you do evil? Should you heal or should you kill? Should you save or should you destroy? Okay, so the answer, according to the old understanding of Sabbath, would be do good, save, don't destroy, don't kill, don't do evil. Okay, this is a gift that God has given, and we are extending this gift. In this case, the Pharisees are extending the gift to their animals, right? But they stopped short of extending this gift to their fellow men, okay? So Jesus, by making these comments, is showing them a different way than they're used to celebrate the Sabbath. He's taking their understanding of these 400 years of all these fences and all the hoops that they have to jump through, and he's saying, let's get back to the way God intended to celebrate the Sabbath, which is the celebration and the extending of gifts. So this is what the Sabbath should have been about, bringing order into chaos, the celebration of that. So now let's go ahead and go back to John, the second page. The hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear shall live. So here we have the Son of God, the voice of the Son of God that brings life. Once again, Jesus is addressing and bringing it back to the creation, the bringing of life. For the Father has life in himself. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son to have life in himself and has given him authority to execute judgment also because he is the Son of Man. So Jesus is tying those two ideas together, life and judgment. The hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. Okay, that's in red, just like the one, not quite the upper one, the one at the top. Those two are parallel to each other because Jesus first says, the ones who hear the voice of the Son of God shall live, but then he expands on it in that second verse. The second verse, okay? So they'll hear his voice and they'll come forth. And then he talks about what to expect at the end times. And then the very last is a brief synopsis in a chiastic form about what Jesus has just said. He sums up his argument in this particular chiasm. I can of myself do nothing. And that's parallel to the very bottom line, but the will of him who sent me. Okay, so he's saying, I can't do anything that I don't see the Father do, the will of him who sent me. And then the one that starts out, as I hear, I judge. And then that's parallel with, because I do not seek my own will. So you could drop out the extra lines in both of those, and it would still be a sentence that makes sense. Okay, as I hear, I judge, I don't seek my own will. It's what I hear from the Father, what I see the Father doing. And Jesus has just talked about that as well. And then the center of that chiasm, my judgment is righteous. And that word righteous is the Greek word because the New Testament is written in Greek. Okay, so we talked about what the Hebrew word righteous meant. And I don't know how much of the Hebrew idea the Greek writer was trying to encompass with his word righteous. But another way of thinking about that would be based on the commands of God. So Jesus is saying, what I do, how I judge, is based on the commands of God. And he is contrasting those to the commands of the Pharisees. He's contrasting God's commands to the fences that the Pharisees have built. So, did Jesus break the Sabbath? It turns out he did not. It turns out that he brought into the Jewish people's life a new idea, which was an old idea, an ancient idea of what the Sabbath was supposed to be. He didn't break the Sabbath, he broke the fences. So when we look at Jesus breaking these fences, we should not say, well, the Sabbath is not important. We don't need to pay attention to the Sabbath anymore. Don't hear me say what I said you couldn't hear me say at the beginning. Okay, this is what the people that Jesus is talking to, how they're looking at this. The fences are broken. The door is open. The wire cage is off the rose bush. You can walk up and you can smell the roses now. And that's the point of the celebration. That's what God wanted them to do in the first place. So Jesus has walked into this situation with this sick man, and he has extended the gift of the Sabbath by bringing order into his chaos, by offering him life. And the man takes that life because the next place we see him is at the temple. So he's getting right with God. He's now at the place where he's supposed to be, with his own God instead of with a pagan God. So what I would like you to hear me saying is that we need to have a different idea of our Sabbath. We need to take all ideas like, I don't know how many of you read Little House on the Prairie and their description, the author's description of how they spent their Sabbath. We need to get rid of that idea. We don't need to go back to what the Jews thought the Sabbath was in Jesus' time. We don't need to go back to this post-Reformation idea that we have of the Sabbath. But we need to take our idea of the Sabbath from the very beginning of what God intended it to be. He intended it to be a gift that he gives us, and he intends it to be a gift that we give to other people. So let's end in prayer. Dear Father, thank you so much for the gifts that you give and for taking into account our humanity and all of our weaknesses. And please let us realize that when you say something is good for us, this is not a command that we have to follow, but that we can embrace what you say. And in embracing it, we can then disseminate it to other people as well. Just thank you for your care for us. In your name, amen.